This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to True Crime Broads. We are so excited today. Our very special guest is here with us in the studio. His name is Kenneth Strange. We call him Ken because we're friends now. But Ken, thank you so much for joining us on True Crime Broads. I did a little bit of an intro before the break, but please introduce yourself to our audience.
Sure, absolutely. Hello, Crystal and Renee, and hello to your audience. My name is Ken Strange, and I live out here in California. I'm semi-retired. I was a federal agent, federal law enforcement agent for 21 years. And I write books now. So
that's awesome.
Yeah, that's what I'm up to. Yeah.
Tell us about your bestseller. I want to hear more about that. And you've got some interesting kind of backstories on these books. So I'll let you start with whichever one you want to talk about first.
Sure. So there are two books out right now, and I have a third kind of in the works. But the I've always wanted to write a book. I've been writing since I was 11 or 12 years old, and I started off with science fiction, and I read as many books as I could. I was just a voracious reader. I started writing, and then I worked on newspapers in the school, and in my town, I moved out to Long Island, a small town out there, and then worked for the newspaper there. And then when I went overseas and did work overseas, I sent in some travel stuff. So, I've always wanted to write. And, as my career kind of wound down, and as I kind of finished the corporate gigs that followed the federal career, I just had a little more time. And, the first book was It's Your Camino. I've got it here. One couple's, I don't know if you can see it, but it's one couple's 500-mile pilgrimage across Spain. And so my wife and I, we walked the Camino in Spain. It's 500 miles in 31 days. And we're still married. Can you imagine after 30? It was a challenge, but we survived. And then, part of the inspiration for that was, I had a background in Spain. I lived in Spain for a little bit. It was my major. I'd been there many, many times. It's like a second home to me. And then, we ran into Martin Sheen and did some volunteer work with him out here down in Mexico. And his was kind, Martin's was kind of the final nudge. He said, Ken, Aurora, you guys really need to go and do this pilgrimage. My son and I did the movie The Way, and which is a wonderful film. And if you haven't seen it, you ought to see it. So that was kind of the final push. And then, we did the Camino, came back, and I looked at my diary, looked at the photos, and I said, this is my book. This is the book I've always wanted to write. So, I spent a few months locked up in this room, and finally, I had a manuscript, and I went back to Martin. He's Martin some days and he's Ramon on other days. It depends on when his real name, as you know, his real name is Ramon Estevez. But so I went back to him and I said, hey, would you mind? And I thought he was going to say, sorry, I'm busy, but he said, no, I'd love to. So I handed him the manuscript. And, you know, again, we're thinking, you know, he's doing that Frankie and Gracie TV show that, that they had. It was during that period. And so I, you know, I was kind of skeptical that anything would happen. And then I get this phone call. I'm in the gym and, you know, unknown number. And it's that Martin Sheen West Wing voice. Ken, it's Martin Sheen. Oh boy, I know. He says, Ken, you're breathing very hard, Ken. What's going on? I said, I don't know. I'm having palpitations, but Martin. So he said, I love the book. And he said, what can I do for you? And I said, well, how about a cover quote for the book? And he said, I'll do it. And again, you know, here we are again. All right, we'll see. And then like a week later, in the mail is this beautiful handwritten letter. And he said, you know, in that cursive writing that nobody knows anymore. Right. And it said, here are like five choices, take any one or a combination thereof. So that's how the first book came into being. It was self-published. And then from there, you know, I'd always wanted to do kind of my career, a memoir, for many reasons, mostly a legacy for my kids. And so that's how the second book came out.
That is so cool. I love I love your connection to Martin Sheen. I remember many, many, many years ago.
And your impression.
I don't know if this is folklore or not, but I think it's true. When he was filming Apocalypse Now, he got so into it that he ended up having a heart attack.
That's right. That's true. That's absolutely true. And you know, it's funny. I told him this. I said, I actually have a connection to you that goes back to 1979. So he's like, huh? You know, huh? Right. And I said, my mother and I met you. Well, not formally, but my mother screamed at you. You probably don't remember in an airport. I think it was JFK, and I was heading out to my first overseas job. We were at the airport, and I was going to step on a flight to London to take me to the Middle East, and I'd be there for the next 5 to 6 years. I think it was, but on that day when we did that, here he comes like out of Los Angeles with his entourage. And my mother says, who's that? And I said, geez, damn, that's Martin Sheen. And I said, God, he just finished Apocalypse Now. And, you know, and he's there with like a fur coat on and, you know, my mother, as we pull up to him, he's coming one way with his group and we're going the other way. As we kind of pull up to him, my mother just suddenly screams out, Martin Sheen. And just like freezes everyone, you know, like you're under arrest, Martin Sheen, you know, that type of thing. And so he looks over and he says, hi, he puts it. So I said, you probably don't remember that, Martin. Right. And he says, you're right, Ken, I don't.
Right.
But I do.
Yeah, that's funny.
That's amazing. Yeah, he was such a big star then. He still is, obviously. But yeah, that was when he was probably just really hitting it big. That's such a cool story.
Yeah, now, wonderful guy. Wonderful guy. Yeah.
So It's Your Camino was your first book that we just discussed with some help from Martin Sheen. Your second book kind of gives us a little more insight into your personal life. It's called A Cop Son. Yeah. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So, in keeping with writing books, you know, again, I wanted to do this memoir, and I remember I was doing a corporate gig somewhere, and somebody said, tell me a story, you know, what did you do? And I'm like, come on, leave me alone. No, really, really, tell me a story. So finally I gave in, and I told the fella the story, and he said, God, whoa, really? That's amazing. You need to write a book. And that's kind of when I started thinking, yeah, you know, but definitely there are some things, you know, I should be talking about and should say. You know, I do want to kind of highlight my father's career because it was such an interesting career that he had. You know, if you think I had a career, boy, this guy, 38 years with NYPD and, you know, rising up through the ranks from patrolman to deputy chief. I think he was in all the boroughs except the Bronx, if I remember. But he had quite a career, so I wanted to make sure that he got into the book because he was in part my inspiration for choosing you know, a law enforcement career.
And, you know, we talked to Tom this morning briefly from Gold Shield. And okay. We told him we were interviewing you today. And he goes, tell Kenny I said hi.
thank you.
We definitely will. But, you know, going back to the NYPD connection here, did your dad and Tom's dad potentially work together and know each other?
I couldn't say. They probably they probably did. My, you know, my father passed in 2020 during COVID. I'm assuming that my father would have known Tom's dad.
Because I know that Tom's dad was also career NYPD. I lost my dad in 2020 as well. Sorry.
Oh, really? No kidding. Yeah. I'm so sorry.
Wow. Oh, thank you. Yes. Wow. Same year.
Oh, wow. Amazing.
Thank you. Yes. And so, so tell us about your background in law enforcement. And we also noticed that you've been a private investigator. We love people with law enforcement backgrounds, true crime writers, and private investigators. And you're all of these things. So let's hear some more about this. I want to hear some more about your background that kind of led you to all these books. Yep. I think I kind of did this interview backwards. We started with the books and I was just excited about the books. Sorry.
So no worries. So, you know, it's kind of, when I reflect on it, my life has been kind of a series of open doors opening at the last moment and me walking through them, and all kind of to this, to kind of a destiny, if you will. And it's, for example, and I'll just summarize. So when I came out of college with my Spanish major, and, you know, I took French and Spanish, was a Spanish major and had done a junior year abroad in Madrid. You know, my goal at the time was to become a high school Spanish teacher. That's all I wanted to do. And although I enjoyed law enforcement and, you know, I idolized my father and you know, the NYPD, they were the good guys. And, you know, I grew up with cops, but I wanted to be a teacher. And so when I got out of college, I started looking around locally in Long Island at the time. And I was kind of seeding the high schools with my resume. And that didn't seem to be working. And I remember we got to January and, like, you know, I'm doing a part-time job just trying to make ends meet, living at home. And about January, I get this phone call from these religious monks in the LaSalle Military Academy on Long Island. And they said, hey, you dropped a resume off for us. And, you know, you're a Spanish teacher. Well, we need a Spanish teacher right now, right this moment. So so that was kind of the first step. And it's strange, no pun intended. But the reason I got the job was because the former Spanish teacher had gotten into some trouble, you know, some misconduct with the students. And so, you know, his problem became my blessing in a way. So now I'm at this school and I'm teaching, you know, it's an exclusive school, and, you know, you kind of look around your classes and there's some, you know, there's some kids and grandkids of mafia folks in there. It's, you know, it's exclusive school. There's some Gambinos and there's a Lucchese and there's this and that, and there's Willie Mays's son. But there's also a lot of foreigners at the school. So while I'm teaching, I'm going into this through the semester. One of the monks says, you know, would you like to, we need someone to teach English as a second language to these students. So I said, I don't know if I can do that. That's not my thing. And they said, well, you know, we'll make it your thing and we'll help you out and we'll subsidize you at the university and we'll get some ESL certificates. And so I said, oh, okay, fine. So that happened. And then, you know, after I completed 2 years at the school, and I kind of wanted to kind of launch myself and become independent from my family, I got this, you know, I saw some ads in the New York Times and it said teaching opportunities in the Middle East. There was one in Israel, there was one in Kuwait, a few in Saudi Arabia. So I sent my resumes out. And the next thing I know, I'm in Houston interviewing for a position in Saudi Arabia as an English teacher. And this position was kind of interesting because the school was a school for the Saudi Arabian royal family. So it was that became quite an incredible experience. So, you know, those doors, and then the next thing I'm in Saudi Arabia, and then I meet this beautiful stewardess who becomes my wife. So that, you know, another door, and then back to the States after the assignment. And, you know, I'm going for an MBA now because I've made enough money I can actually go back to school. And then, you know, I'm in the school, and then the FBI comes on the campus recruiting people.
Oh,
and
wow.
And not just FBI, but the CIA, because this was kind of an international school and, you know, a lot of people with different backgrounds, languages. So this FBI agent came, I think he was out of the Salt Lake City office, and he said, yeah, you know, we kind of like your background. You know, would you think about it? And I said, yes, I will. So kind of, again, all these doors kind of opening.
That's awesome. And what about, I know you were a private investigator for a while. What, so your FBI career though, how long was that, your FBI career?
So my FBI career was actually 3 years. And after that, I got an offer from it was called the secret in the U.S. government, according to the people that recruited me. And these were ex-FBI agents who said, hey, you know, we heard you do some pretty good work. We've heard about you. You know, would you like to join us? Because we do work all over the world, and we investigate fraud. And I said, you know, I don't know anything about fraud. And they said, we'll teach you. And so, you know, I love traveling, as you can surmise. And, you know, they said, well, we'll put you right into Costa Rica with your Spanish. And I said, okay, you know, that's, I'll try it. You know, again, another door opening. And I chose to go through that door.
That's really, really cool.
That is cool.
And so, tell us a little bit about your U.S.-Mexican border work with the Department of Justice. You know, that's been in the news a lot lately.
Right.
How long ago was that you were doing that kind of work?
So I got down to El Paso in 1998, and I was there for the next 5 years. Okay. Before I was promoted and then transferred to Los Angeles.
Man, so been all over the place. So yeah. That was one of my questions, is I know you're from New York.
Yeah.
How did you get to Los? How did you get to, you're in Covina now?
I'm in Thousand Oaks.
Oh, sorry. Okay. Yeah. Oh, that's a nice area. So what brought you to California?
My wife's family. Actually, she said, you know, Ken, it's, you know, you've been on the East Coast with your family, and, you know, I've followed you all over the place, and, you know, it's time. I want to see my family. So, aww. You know, there was this opportunity in Los Angeles, you know, it was a promotion and a challenge. And I said, okay, let's do it. And, you know, we'll get to see your mother every weekend.
That's awesome.
Oh, that is good.
Yeah. I love LA. It's, lived for 2 years, but I didn't live anywhere nice like Thousand Oaks. I lived next to the La Brea tar pits.
Oh yeah, sure. Yeah. I know them.
That was a long time ago. So I think that the area is a lot nice. I've visited since then. That area is so much nicer than it was when I lived there. Right. You know, usually areas go downhill, but I was shocked to see that area is way down.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Yeah, the La Brea, you're right. And it was at one point, and then it's kind of evolved. You're right. You're absolutely
right. My actual neighborhood is like way better than it was. I guess maybe, I don't know what happens. Maybe the real estate went up and people sold, and I don't know what happened, but it was just really nice. And it was no longer it was just kind of a downtrodden neighborhood when I lived there, but nice now. Okay, so what do you have going on now? You said you're working on a third book.
So I'm about three quarters of the way through this. It's called Land of Sand, so you have a very good idea what I'd be writing about.
Right.
So it's really a coming of age love story set in the Middle East. And, you know, before all those memories become extinct and vanish, I just wanted to make sure that that I wrote them down, because there's some, you know, I lived during a very interesting part of time in the Middle East. There was a lot of things happening. It was the kind of it was the beginning of Middle East terrorism coming our way. And, you know, I was kind of on the ground floor because I'm there maybe 2 months, and the Saudi rebels, see, you know, they seize Mecca, you know, the mosque in Mecca, and they killed a lot of Saudi soldiers. And, we were hanging out with nurses, these British nurses, who were telling us, you know, we'd have a few drinks on a weekend or something, and they say, oh yeah, all these soldiers came in, they lost limbs, you know, dead people, and so a real fight out there. So that was going on, and then you had the Iranian hostage crisis. I lived in the most orthodox Islamic country in the world, so you know, it was very austere and difficult. And if you had your cross, well, you didn't do it. If you had a necklace with a cross, you didn't wear it outside, because, you know, they didn't take very kindly to those displays of your religion. You know, their religion was fine. It was quite an experience and quite an education for me.
I can imagine.
Sounds like incredible. Sure. Okay. So I saw in your bio that you had some interactions with Ray Bradbury, the author. Can you talk about that? That's intense.
Yeah. So, this goes back to being a kid, and you know, I'm raised in Brooklyn. I live in this lower middle class place in Brooklyn. And you know, it was great. Being a kid was great, because you always had friends there in the street. And I loved to read, and so there was a library maybe half a mile from the house, and I spent a lot of time in this library, and I just was fascinated with Ray Bradbury and science fiction. So I read everything I could about Bradbury, and you know, I did some of the other authors as well, but in particular, I loved his books. And as I, you know, got older and older, occasionally I'd grab one of his books and, you know, go over it again and really enjoyed it. And then, I'm working in Los Angeles, and I have 1 year left in my career. And so I remember taking lunch, going down, I was in Glendale, going down Brand Boulevard, and came up to one of these indie bookstores on Brand Boulevard. So I go in, and there's a sign, little sign that says Ray Bradbury's 88th birthday next week. Please come. You know, he's doing a book signing. So I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe it. You know, right? Oh my God, I'm getting ready. I'm going to get a suit. I'm going to look good. So the week passes, and I get there like 2 hours early, and I grabbed a book off the shelf, Martian Chronicles. And it's packed, and it's a small place, but it was packed fun. There was a cake. Everyone was in a festive mood. And then all of a sudden, he is wheeled in a wheelchair, and it's the person wheeling him in is Bo Derek. The actress, you know, from the movie 10. Yeah. And so apparently they're friends. So, you know, she wheels him in, and everyone's singing happy birthday, and they're cutting the cake. And then, you know, all of a sudden, okay, Ray will sign books. So, you know, I get on the conga line, and so I'm just, but I'm looking and I'm thinking, how am I going to do this? I'm pretty tall, and Ray's in this, he's in a wheelchair. So at the last minute, it's my turn. And at the last minute, I go before him, and I go into this kind of catcher's crouch. And so I hand him the book, he takes the book, and I just said, you know, Ken, go for it. Tell him how much you love him, you know, what he's meant in your life. And I did. I just said, you know, you made such a difference in my life. And, you know, you took me out of that, out of Brooklyn, and I could travel to other planets. And, I love you. And so he just,
that is so cool.
He reaches out and he pulls me in, and I'm like going, oh my God, I'm going to fall on the guy, because I'm on this crouch on my balls on my feet. And then he just, but he held me, has a great strength in his arms. And then he just pulled me in and he kissed me on the cheek. And I just got a kiss by my hero.
You know, that was not long before he passed away. That was like 2 or 3 years before he died.
Exactly right. That's exactly right. You're right. So, yeah.
Was Martian, was the Martian book your favorite, or was that just the one that was on the
that was just the closest one.
Wasn't Fahrenheit 451 like his most famous book?
Yes. Okay. Fahrenheit 451, Martian Chronicles, and some of the others. But, you know, I tell the story, and, you know, with guys, if I tell it to guys, they're like, oh, who cares? If it was Bo Derek gave you a kiss, that would have been different.
That is a cool story for an author to get to meet the author that, you know, he first got into. And that's really
that
cool.
That is so cool.
Yeah.
I sent, you know, it's funny. I sent his daughters a blog about that encounter. And I received a letter saying, very touching. We're very touched. Thank you for that. So that really made my day.
Yeah, that's so nice. I love that. So I noticed also on your bio here that it talks about you being a private investigator.
Right.
And I wanted to see if you could tell us something about that.
Sure, absolutely. So, you know, my federal career had wound up 21 years, and then I went into a series of corporate gigs, and I was paid very well and did some pretty interesting stuff. Some of it overseas, maybe half of it overseas. But, you know, there came a point where, you know, and I think everybody experiences this at least once in their life with a boss where you just don't click. And so in my last gig, I was really not clicking with this boss. And, you know, this boss was firing people left and right. And I think it was just a matter of time before, you know, my head would be cut. So I said, I'm going to resign. I resigned. And I said, I want to have my own business and I want to be accountable to myself and I want to call the shots. So, you know, I studied for the PI exam here in California, passed it, and then, you know, started doing PI work. I soon found that I really enjoyed missing persons cases. And I had one that was... tragic. So I had one of those, and then there was another case where, you know, we were able to exonerate someone that was being accused of a quarter million dollar robbery over in Glendale with a cast of characters. The people that were part of it, and I'm interviewing these people at this. It was like Harry Bosch. You know, Detective Bosch.
I love that show.
It was like a Michael Connelly thing. I mean, you know, just going around the table talking to these people. There's a gangbanger from Compton. There's a cartel guy from Mexico. There's a Russian mobster with Armenian ties. I mean, it's just, very nice people, you know, that you talk to them. But as you get to open them up, you know, hey, I did time in Big Spring, Texas federal prison. I'm like, oh, my God. Yeah, I know that place. I used to go in there. So that was an incredible case. That sticks out in my mind because, you know, the client, and this was a interesting guy. He was on a skateboard. He skateboards over to the hotel where we're going to meet. He's got a studded, you know, diamond on his ear, and a black kid with a skateboard. And so he says, "I'm innocent. I didn't do it." You know how it goes, Mr. Strange. So, you know, I said, "Okay, well, let's see what we can see." And then we found a piece of evidence that the police had not seen. And I don't blame the police because they're into all kinds of stuff and they're busy, but it was just a little old Armenian, you know, this Armenian lady with one of these CCTV cameras in a tiny little shop that just saved this kid's bacon. Because, you know, I kind of did my due diligence and I just said, you know what, I'm going to take that extra step tonight. And so I turned the corner, went down the street, and then I see this CCTV camera, and it's like a grocery store. It's an Armenian grocery store. I go in and I meet this lady, can't even speak English. And I said, you know, camera, is that live? Is it? And she goes, you police? And I said, no. And she goes, good. Come on, I'll show you. So, and then she takes me into this. And as I walk into the store, it keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And there's groceries and there's sweets and all kinds of stuff. And then we get into her office. And it, you know, it would be the envy of many police departments, all the screens all over the room, you know, different angles of the store. There's the apples and there's the sweets. And then there's the street. And wow. So I said, does this work? And she gets a technician to come in, plays it back to that night of the robbery. And sure enough, here walks this guy with this bag of money, looks up at the camera. Thank you very much.
Right.
Goes across the street with his, you know, Santa Claus bag.
Right.
And now we can, he jumps into a car, you know, it's the getaway car, and there's the plate. So I said, oh my God, the client is not the bad guy. We've just exonerated the bad guy. And all thanks to this little woman, you know.
Right.
So it was pretty cool. You know, went down to the police department. I said, you really need to see this. So that's what happened. That was a fun, interesting case.
That's a great story. I love that.
Thanks.
Being able to exonerate someone is the best.
Yes.
Absolutely. Sure. Yeah. I mean, you want to get the bad guys, but if you can exonerate people along the way, so much the better.
Did you ever have to do any, like, I mean, I'm sure you did, like surveillance of, you know, cases where you kind of prove somebody's cheating or not cheating or whatever?
Yes. In fact, it's funny you mentioned that. It was, I think, my first surveillance case. And it was down in, I think, Newport Beach or that area. And it was, and you know, the people that hire you sometimes, maybe they're the ones that should be getting investigated. It was a Russian guy out of Miami. And he said, you need, you know, this girl, we need her followed. And, you know, I didn't ask questions, but it was funny because, you know, it's been a while since I'm working with surveillance cameras and stuff. So, you know, I get on the street, it's nighttime, and now I see the subjects, her apartment, her window, and she's got the blinds open and she's like taking her clothes off. And I'm like, oh my God.
You see in the movies. Wow.
just like that.
That's funny.
I'm like, oh my God, please don't call me a peeping Tom. But,
right.
Yeah, that was interesting. But I started to kind of stop, evolved, kind of got away from those types of cases. They're really not my, really not my thing.
Right. I get it. Yeah. I want to be a PI, but I don't really, yeah. I guess you have to at some point.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, sometimes you have to, for the grocery money to make your grocery money.
Well, but, and that seems to be like one of the top reasons why people hire PIs anyway.
Yeah.
Right.
What we've been able to tell. So, yeah.
But it was the missing persons stuff that I liked the most. And I'll just give you a real quick one. So I got a call from a couple in the Valley here, San Fernando Valley. And they said, hey, we heard about you, you know, can you help us? Our son, who is autistic, has run away and we haven't seen him in a week. And you know, he's autistic. He's got some.
Gary, how old was he?
Now, that's a great question, because he was in his, I think, late 20s, early 30s. He was a USC graduate, a very successful businessman, but something happened along the way where he just, and I don't know what it was, maybe some kind of pressure in his life where he lost his job. Now he had to come home and live with the family, and he just started letting himself go. You know, the classic depression type thing. So he vanishes, and I said, look, I'll give it a week. You know, give me a list of everybody he knows, places he likes to frequent, blah blah blah. And we got all the way up to the last day, and I kid you not, we got to the last witness. And this was a girlfriend that he had in college. And so she's up in San Francisco. I give her a call, leave a message. She calls me back. And then she says, he just called me. And in fact, he's at the Golden Gate Bridge and he's threatening to jump off.
Oh my gosh.
And I said, wow. Well, number one, thank God I found you. Here's what you do. Talk him off the bridge. You know, I'll make a few calls. So I called the San Francisco Police Department. And then apparently there's a police department for the Golden Gate Bridge. Obviously, they're, you know, they have a lot of jumpers.
Yeah.
And I'm learning this as I'm going along. So she was able to talk him down from jumping off the bridge. I mean, he was right there at the bridge. And she said, look, I'm going to take him in for a few days. My husband and I, we're going to take him in for a few days. And just kind of calm him down. And so that happened. You know, he kind of decompressed a little bit. And then his parents went up there and they picked him up. And I remember the mother saying to me, Mr. Strange, what do I do now? And I said, I don't know. I said, that's not my thing. You know, you're the parent. Mm-hmm. So anyway, sadly enough, 3 months later, he went back to the bridge, and this time he jumped.
He's no longer with us. That's horrible.
He's no longer with us. But you know, the mother wrote me a letter, and she said, "Thank you for giving me 3 more months with my son."
Oh.
You know, it's just that was a tragedy.
Yeah, that's so sad.
Yeah, 100%. Do you, when you were a private investigator, did you find that police departments, let's say you were, did you ever do like a murder case or any other kind of crime? And if so, were the police cooperative or were you working independently on that case from the police?
Yeah, no, the answer is no. I did not work any homicide cases. Okay. So I don't have that experience. Couldn't really talk to it.
Right.
What I did notice is, you know, the police have so much on their plate that, you know, sometimes they welcome PIs that, you know, understand law enforcement, and sometimes we'll kind of help each other out. Right. But in answer to your question, no, I never did.
Okay. So what's next, Ken? What should we be looking for?
Wow. So great question. You know, again, I'm coming up on that, finishing the third book, and, you know, I'm also, hopeful that, you know, I became involved in another missing person case, but this one is my neighbor, Annie McCarrick, who, she disappeared, and she disappeared in 1993, actually 31 years ago today. Is the anniversary. Just vanished without a trace. And, you know, subsequent to her disappearance, they had about 6 or 7 other girls vanish, kind of in the same circumstances, without a trace, and kind of all in the approximate area, same area, which they called the vanishing triangle. So the case last year, I worked with the family, and I got some FBI profilers involved as well. So I've done everything I've could, but I have to kind of step back and let the Irish police, do what they do. I get phone calls, I get letters, emails from people in Ireland with tips. There's not much I can do with them here in California. So I have a connection in the Irish police, and I send everything they send me to him. So we're hoping and we're praying that eventually she'll be found. And I think, you know, just and I had, you know, the there's a really strong relationship with the family, because, and it's sad because she was the only child of John and Nancy McCarrick, the only child, and she loved Ireland, studied in Ireland, and then was going to make she's looking for a business career in Ireland, and then she disappears. So, you know, I remember meeting her mother in the church. She would go to the early church mass, like 8 o'clock mass. And I bumped into her, and she said, Ken, I know I'm never going to see my daughter again, but could you bring her home? And I mean, that hits pretty close. That's tough. So hopefully there's been not to confuse the matter, but there's been a serial killer, we think, that is involved, not necessarily in her disappearance, but some of the other ladies, because I actually got involved in their cases, too. But there's a fella that was arrested back in 2000, released in 2010. So he may have had something to do with the other cases, and I believe he has. But Annie's cases are just a little different. And it was only when I went there about 2 years ago and I retraced her steps that I started to have doubts. You know, everybody is looking for this at this serial killer type guy who the FBI profiled, by the way. And John Douglas was knows all about it. And the Bureau said, yeah, this guy, the other guy, he's a serial rapist, if not a serial killer. But when I'm sitting there with the police and I'm talking to this fella, I said, how credible is that sighting of Annie McCarrick leaving Dublin, going to this small town? And he didn't say anything and he just kind of smiled. And I knew exactly what he meant, that maybe we're going down the wrong hole here. And maybe it's right in plain sight. And then last year, when they upgraded the case from a missing persons to a murder case, you know, they started to take a very close look at two brothers who knew her fairly well. And apparently, and we just found out about a year ago, there was a relationship between Annie and the younger brother, which kind of devolved into a kind of assault. If you will, there was an assault or two, and we just found out, and it's been an incredible, it's a roller coaster ride. I hope, you know, so many years have passed, and I hope justice will be done.
Man, I hope that gets
seriously.
Solved.
Yes.
Amen.
No, well, thank roller coaster.
And you're such a blessing to the family to stay on for all these years, and especially with it being so far away.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
A lot of great work.
Well, really enjoyed having you on our show, Ken. Thank you for coming on. And those of you that are listening, we'll link your books in the show notes. And
thank you.
And his name is Ken Strange. And I'm assuming that your books are available on Amazon.
Amazon, Barnes and Noble. Yes.
All right. Awesome. Thank you so much for coming on our show, Ken. We'll look forward to talking to you in the future and keep in touch. And we will talk to you soon. Thanks. Have a great day.
Thank you, Crystal. Thank you, Renee. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye now.